The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 200 for Thursday, July 24th, 2014. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where we come to you with your questions, with your tips. Next week, with your cool stuff found, we answer your questions, we share your tips, and next week we'll share your cool stuff found as well as some of the stuff we found. And the goal is together to all learn at least four new things about the Mac, Apple, technology, all of that good stuff. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. If you go create a site with Squarespace and tweet about it with Squarespace shout out as your hashtag, we'll retweet it too and tell everybody to come visit you. This episode is also sponsored by the great folks at Drobo. Drobo.com, D-R-O-B-O.com. Coupon code MGG gets you $50 off of any Drobo unit, including the Gen 3 Drobo that retails for $349. So you can get it for less than $300 with our coupon code. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Hi, John.
Dave, what episode is this again?
It's episode 512 in decimal.
Okay.
Yes.
And in other units, what could it be?
Well, in hexadecimal, it's 200. Which is what I did at the beginning of the show. In binary, it's one and a lot of zeros, and I can't remember exactly right. How many. but yes, it okay. Is only one in binary, just lots of zeros after it.
So yeah, so I want to get that clear.
Yes.
So 200 in hex.
Well, do we call it 200? I forget hex pronunciation, which is why I said it the way I did.
I believe the pronunciation is the same because they are normal. You just got to make sure to say either base 16 or hexadecimal.
Right. That's right.
Because then that sets the the value of each digit. Hexadecimal, of course, is 2 to the 4th, 2, 4, 8, 16. Right. And things that are digital, we love to put in powers of 2, whether it be 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2. But because binary is what computers are all about.
So. Yeah. It's true. It's true. Des Pravda, as they say in Russia.
What?
I think that's what is true is. I'm not going to tell you where that came from. It's an old Saturday Night Live skit. Yeah. So here we are. You know what? I have no idea where this is going to go, this show today. It's a little crazy. It's a Thursday afternoon. It's been a crazy week for me. I'm leaving in the morning. I'm not yet packed. And
Hamilton family band tour.
Well, this is actually the tomorrow morning. Lisa and I leave just the two of us. Well, actually, we leave with our daughter, too. Our son's already at sleepaway camp for another 3 weeks. But our daughter will come with us for the first half of the journey, and we will drop her off with some relatives halfway to where we're going. We're going to Lisa and I are then going on I say it's a fishing trip with a PH at the beginning, and no, we're not out to try and get your credit card numbers. We're going to see four shows by the band Fish, and also just have some R&R kind of around that. Sure. So we're spending the first couple of days in Columbia, Maryland, and then from there we will migrate a little further south and east to Portsmouth, Virginia. Actually, I think we're staying across the Elizabeth River in Norfolk, Virginia.
Ooh. Yeah. Portsmouth, Virginia, not Portsmouth,
New Hampshire.
Maine.
No.
New Hampshire, sorry.
Yeah, right. No. So that's I think the first one's about 8 hours from home, and then Portsmouth, Virginia, coming back from there will be about a 10-hour ride home. But that's what we're doing. Sweet. So.
Yeah, I think one of our former colleagues is down in Maryland.
Look
him up there. And also Maryland, based on what I know, you can probably get some good crab cakes there, right?
I believe we could get good crab cakes. Right. Yes. Yes. I think that's right. That's a thing.
That's their deal down there.
Yeah, it's a thing. So we're looking forward to it. And so that's why we're doing the show today. But, John, an hour ago, well, maybe an hour and a half ago, but an hour before we synced up, Jeff Gamet was having some internet problems. And so he couldn't host the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast today, which he usually does. And so Brian Chaffin, Kelly Gamont, and I did it. And I did the recording on this end because, you know, I'm all set up here. It's easy. And so I did it. No problem. Right. Recorded the show. We did it. We'll probably push the file out. Brian pushed out the article, or Jeff pushed out the article, or whichever it was. And all was good. And this was like 2:15. You and I were going to meet at 3 Eastern. And I thought, you know, I should reboot this machine because, you know, we've had some weird issues and with the timing and the USB and all that. It's helpful to reboot. So I rebooted and the machine wouldn't come up. It would get to the Apple logo and the little spinny geary thing. And that was the end of it. So I booted in verbose mode by holding down Command V to see what was going on. Because when that thing's spinning, it usually means that there's an error message on the screen or something that you can't see. And there was no error message, but it didn't. So Command V gets rid of that gray screen and lets you see what's behind it. You have to reboot with Command V. You can't just toggle it on and off. So I did that and it came back up to that same point and then just sat. There was nothing happening. So I went into single user mode to do a file system check, and FSCK wouldn't even repair the disk. So this was a perfectly working machine. I literally had used it a second prior to restarting it, and then it wouldn't start back up. And I'm thinking, crap, now I have 40 minutes until you and I are supposed to meet here, John. But thankfully, I had this Samsung drive. You know, I'd have the SanDisk SSD inside here. I have the Samsung drive that I was using and testing connected via USB, but I had cloned to it maybe 2 weeks ago when I talked about it. I thought, well, okay, you know, here we go. So I booted from the USB clone and I logged. And then I thought, oh, wait, I can be smart about this. I logged into my test user account. I didn't want to muck with logging into my real user account here. Because I knew I was going to clone back to this. And I figured the less I mess with it, the better, the easier that cloning operation is going to go. So I logged into the test account and launched Carbon Copy Cloner. And immediately the finder came up and said, we can read the disk that's in the standard boot disk. We can read it, but we can't write to it. So you better get your data off it right away. Like, okay, great. No problem. So I launched Carbon Copy Cloner. I told it, clone from the boot disk, from the internal disk to the USB disk. And it didn't yell at me. It told me it wasn't going to clone any system stuff because the disk that I was cloning to my boot drive, which is a little non-standard, right? Normally you'd boot from a drive and clone somewhere else, but this was not a standard scenario. So I told it to do that. It took, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes to go through and parse all the files and then copy the ones that had changed. And then I booted up from this drive over USB again, and logged into my account, and everything worked. It took a little while, as folks in the pre-show saw, it took a little while for Dropbox to sync up and, you know, all those things that kind of happen, building Spotlight caches, which I think is still going on in the background, which I don't really like, but here we are. And I launched Drive Genius. I'd launched Disk Utility to see if it would repair the drive, and it wouldn't. I launched Drive Genius to see if it would repair. It wouldn't. I asked Drive Genius to do a rebuild on the file structure, and it wouldn't. So I had had this problem with this SanDisk drive a couple of weeks ago, which was the reason that I brought this new. I wanted to test the Samsung drive anyway. But the reason the way I tested it was I brought it up. I cloned the SanDisk drive to it and reformatted the SanDisk drive. And so I've already been through this once with this SanDisk drive. So maybe, it's one drive. I'm not going to fault SanDisk for making bad drives in general, but this one in particular has now failed twice in this machine. So once I put the Samsung drive inside this machine, which I will. We'll see how it does, and then we'll know whether my issue is the drive or is the machine, right? Because it's possible that there's some motherboard issue or cabling issue or whatever. So,
yeah.
So that's where I'm living right now.
Okay, because I want to be careful about pointing at, you know, any particular drive mechanism, SSD or otherwise, as being the cause of the problem, since
Right.
You know, you're kind of futzing around with things and kind of, you know, messing around where you shouldn't be. So,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Go blaming the, well.
No, I'm not blaming. I'm not blaming. And that's what I was saying is I don't yet know whether I can point my finger at the SanDisk drive or something else. We'll know once I have a month or two in with the Samsung drive, you know, and I'll test the SanDisk drive elsewhere and maybe then it'll be obvious that there's a problem with it or maybe not. You know, yeah. So
because I guess I would agree that, you know, the degree of data integrity that you have on an SSD is, if not equal, better than that on a spindle drive.
Right. Right.
Yeah, right. I'm cautious about that because memory cells can go bad, as can the physical media on a rotational drive.
Sure. Sure.
And the drive should be able to deal with that. So, yeah, so I'm
this SanDisk drive,
like, we're leaning towards it maybe being drive corruption. And it sounds like that remains to be seen. It's certainly possible, but sure. it seems to be kind of unlikely.
This SanDisk drive,
well, corruption in that the data it doesn't matter. The media type is that the data is somehow confused, which is why, you know, all these repair operations fail. They're like, no, things are too screwed up. I'm not even going to try this.
Dude. Yeah. Yeah. But the fact that it's the second time this exact same issue has happened in 3 weeks tells me I have some kind of hardware problem. Now, whether my hardware problem is a bad cable, a bad controller, or a bad drive, we're going to narrow down.
Because that's what we do.
Yeah. But this, you know,
I'm with you now. Well, it happened twice with the same drive.
Yeah. Sure, part of why I'm leaning towards it being the drive is that's an easy fix for me because I have extra drives to put in and cost me nothing. So that's actually really good. Part of why I'm so there's the optimistic part of me that hopes it's just the drive. Because in my circumstance, that's actually a good thing. But part of why I think it might be the drive is this drive has had an interesting history. It came to me via, it was like part of a RAID thing that I was testing. And it was, I'm not exactly sure of this drive's history. Let's put it that way. So, it may not be, who knows where this drive has been. We'll just leave it at that. So I wouldn't, even if it is the drive, like I said, I'm not going to point fingers and say SanDisk drives are bad. They're actually quite good from what I've experienced. This one's just had a rough start in life. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. I'll keep you guys posted though, because it's what we do. But I'm looking forward to putting this Samsung in here and really giving that a workout. So this is a good excuse to pull that, to have to pull this iMac apart again. The problem is I don't have my chief assistant for the next 3 weeks because that's usually my son. He's awesome at helping me take these machines apart. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I might have to enlist someone else. Maybe you got to come up and visit, John. All right.
To work on your stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There might be some parts missing, but yeah, sure.
Right,
sure.
Yeah. Well, you know.
After I'm done.
After you're done. That's it. You made it more efficient. If you can make it run well with less parts, who's to say that's bad? Right. All right. Speaking of your machine running well, let's let Michael ask the next question.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Michael calling from New York City. Question to the two of you about iStat menu. Not that it doesn't do a great job, but that I wonder sometimes if it makes me worry needlessly. Yesterday I had a MacBook Pro 15 inch from 2007 that has served me pretty well. Oh, it served me very well, obviously. Started to have some issues the last week. But the point being that I had iStat Pro and I'm monitoring my 4 gigs of RAM that I have installed on that machine. And it always, especially since I got to like Lion and Mountain Lion, and then I tried Mavericks, God forgive me. It just seemed to eat up memory. And it was a sluggish machine, despite that. My cat is screaming at me.
All of
it was a sluggish machine. Today, I bought a brand new MacBook Pro 13-inch, 8 gigs of RAM, kind of the baseline 2.4 gigahertz, installed iStat menu, and it looks like it's eaten, my RAM is getting eaten up. And I wonder, do I just shut that off and not look at it? Is something going on? And obviously the machine works very well because it's, you know, 10 hours or 5 hours old. But, you know, how much of that is something I need to really know and keep an eye on, and how much of it is just, don't worry about it. It's the you know, the man behind the curtain. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Yeah. So we will pull the curtain aside a little bit. iStat menus shows free RAM in two different ways. And I find one of them very informative and very good to watch, and the other not helpful at all for my purposes anyway. If you go into iStat menus, and we're talking about iStat menus 4, which I realize has been out for probably well over a year now. But if you're not running 4, then this, you'll find this in a different spot, and you should go get 4 anyway. So, but in you launch the app, go into the memory tab where you configure the memory section, where you configure how you want memory to display. And there's a checkbox there that says show inactive as free or show inactive memory as free memory. You don't want that checked. And the reason is OS X will do its darndest to fill things up, and it's not overly helpful. If you see for me, it's not helpful to see things as free that aren't actually free, because OS X manages memory differently. My experience is that if my free memory, truly my free memory, gets below about 100 megabytes, 50 is really the number, 50 megabytes. But if I see it below 100, I know I'm getting close. If it gets below 50 megabytes, I'm doing something that is causing significant RAM usage. Otherwise, it's going to sit anywhere between about 100 and 1,000. And this is, you know, on my machines that have 6 gigs of RAM, it's on my machines that have 12 gigs of RAM. But if you see that free memory number drop into the double digits, true free memory, not inactive plus free equals free memory, then yeah, it is good to watch, and you should obsess over it, because when you see your free memory dip down that low, it means that your Mac doesn't have enough memory to do what you're doing and will be moving into swap and all that. Now, your new machine probably has an SSD, so moving into swap isn't quite the disaster performance-wise that it used to be, but it's also just in general not a good thing. If you're constantly moving into swap, you know, you might need more RAM or just need to quit some apps. So yeah, I think it is helpful. I mean, listen, iStat menus is, you know, OCD paradise, right? You can totally freak out over all that stuff, and I often do, but in this instance, it's actually quite helpful. So, you know, that's my thoughts on it, John. How about you?
I want to try to figure out what was there a concern about the how much memory iStat menus or processor it was taking?
That's not how I heard his question. He was more about what it's reporting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I thought he was suggesting that, you know, should I be running it because, you know, it takes up memory or processor?
No.
And, you know, as far as I can see, it takes up very little. If it's taking up any, then yeah, then something's wrong.
No, I think what he was asking was, you know, should I even have that part of it turned on, or am I going to wind up obsessing about something that doesn't matter? And the answer is no, it does matter.
Yeah, it does. And I'm with you. And I'm still using Memory Keeper. And on both of my machines, as long as it's about a gigabyte, which I find normal, in the, you know, whether it be Mavericks or Mountain Lion managing the memory, they seem to do a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. When it shows, so I have it in my menu bar, and when it shows, I mean, typically I think it shows if you have less than 10% free memory, then it goes red. And that's probably a sign that, yeah, something's not quite right at the moment. And if it, you know, gets worse, then yeah.
Yeah. Right. 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 All right. You know what I want to do, John? I want to talk about Drobo. I'm excited. Drobo is our first sponsor today, and they, they've been in business a long time. The folks who started things over there are back and have been back for about a year now. So the products that we're seeing coming out from them are led and generated by the new management, which is a very, very good thing. Jeff Beryl and Mark Fuccio and Jim Sherratt and the whole team there, those folks know what they're doing. So today we get to talk about the new third generation Drobo, which is a direct attached device. It's USB 3, right? So you get super speeds out of the thing. And just in general, it is somewhere between 3 and 5 times faster than the previous direct attached Drobos. It's been a while since we've seen a direct attached Drobo come out. The, the Gen 2 Drobo was, I think it's 8 years old, right? But this one, it's got new guts in it, new smarts, which help make it faster. It's got a dual core processor in there, which seems crazy to need in an attached drive unit, but it is the right thing because what a Drobo does is you put disks into it. It is a 4-bay unit. You take SATA disks and put them in there, and it will do 2 things with those disks. Number one, it compiles all of them together. They don't all have to be the same size. You don't even have to think about that. You just put the disks in. It compiles them all together into one volume that it shows to your Mac. And then it also uses one of those drives as fault tolerance, which means if any drive fails, you can take it out and replace it, and you won't lose any of your data, which is cool. I mean, it's super cool. And these direct attached Drobos, it's that easy to set up. You plug it in and you run some software to manage it, but that's it. The management is trivial at that point. It just kind of set it up and then you go. And if you need to put disks in, you just put a disk in. So it's great. If you've got some extra SATA drives lying around, you don't have to use all 4 bays at once. I recommend using at least 2 of them so that you get some fault tolerance. With using 3, now you start to get some real storage options because one of the disks is always going to be reserved for fault tolerance and all of that. But you don't have to use 4, and you can just put in whatever drives you've got. And then as you need more space, you take out the smallest one and put in a one that's larger than that. And now you have more space, and it's cool. You can go actually on their site. They have a capacity calculator that you can go to the site and say, here's the drives I have, and I'm going to put them in a 4-bay Drobo unit, and it will calculate how much storage you'll get out of that, including the deduction that it's going to make for the fault tolerance, so that you can lose a drive and still keep going. So really, really cool. You can also turn on 2-disk fault tolerance in the third gen Drobo. Obviously, you get less space out of that, but you get far more reliability far more fault tolerance, right? You can lose 2 disks at once and still keep going. I run mine on 1. I live on the edge, I guess, but it works. It's good. So this is cool. This is, it's a cool thing. They've actually optimized it for us Mac users with Time Machine. Now, even though it's a direct attached unit, you can create a separate disk volume to use with Time Machine, and the beauty is you can set a maximum size for that volume so that Time Machine doesn't eat up the entirety of the space on your Drobo, which it would otherwise if you pointed Time Machine to this. So you can set how much space you want Time Machine to take up, and then you point Time Machine at that separate store and off you go. You can also use that dedicated volume for creating an encrypted drive using OS X's disk utility, right? So if you want to store encrypted stuff, you can do that now. The Drobo supports that now. It's great stuff. I highly recommend checking it out. And the cool thing is this Gen 3 Drobo, because it's USB, you're not paying the FireWire tax, which wasn't much, but you're not paying the Thunderbolt tax, which is a huge deal, both for the port and the cable you'd have to buy. Because it's just USB 3, they sell this thing for $349. So you get a 4-bay unit empty for $349. You can buy it from them with discs too, but you probably have some extra discs laying around that you can use to populate this thing. So $349, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, MGG50 is the coupon code that gets you $50 off. So you can buy this thing for $299 from drobostore.com. So check it out. Drobo.com will get you there. You can learn all about it. Drobostore.com is where you buy it, and your coupon code is MGG50. So check it out and let them know you heard about it here. We appreciate it, and so do they. Again, Drobo.com, MGG50 is the coupon code. Get your $50 off. All right, John, let's go to Bob, shall we?
Indeed.
Mr. Bob, it's a good question. Bob says, back in the days of Leopard and Snow Leopard, I used to be able to provide remote desktop type support to my friends and relatives by acquiring an AIM account and using iChat to switch to a remote desktop type connection. For the past couple of years, I haven't had to do this, but now I do. I really don't get how to do this now with Mavericks and Messages. Further complicating this for me is that the person I need to be able to connect with has a Mac Mini, so no mic or video camera. I'd prefer to use the built-in Apple tools to do this rather than something like Log Me In. Back to my Mac isn't practical as we're not sharing an Apple ID. Any thoughts that might be helpful? So I have two thoughts for you. Number one is you can still do it through AIM. But the weird part is that's not obvious at all. You go into the Messages app and you see, if you go to the menus, you will see that one of the items is grayed out. It says share my screen or so. I'm going to launch the Messages app because I'm living on the edge here, John.
Man.
What's that?
Don't do it, man.
Yeah, I just did it. So hopefully we don't lose containment here. But you can say share my screen in the Buddies menu is share my screen and ask to share remote screen. And so I go and highlight John F. Braun because I sent you an iMessage earlier today, right? And I go to the Buddies list and it's grayed out. Why is it grayed out, right? Why is share my screen with John F. Braun and ask to share my screen with John F. Braun grayed out? It's crazy. Even invite to video chat and invite to audio chat are grayed out here. And the reason is this doesn't work with contacts with whom you have iMessage connections. It only works with contacts that you have AIM, AOL Instant Messenger connections. And you can add those to the Messages app. Go to Messages, Preferences, Accounts, add an AIM account here, log into AIM, and then the person that you're talking to has to also have an AIM account. And then once you're there, then all those options light up and everything's golden. Very confusing. Took Guy Searle and I probably a half hour to figure that out, and we were determined. That's the only reason. We're two like stubborn, well, you know, we're bullheaded guys.
Yeah,
that's right. So you still can do it that way. And it works totally fine in Mavericks. I haven't tried it in Yosemite, but it works totally fine. So that's option number one. The other option would be TeamViewer that I can think of, probably easier. Maybe, I don't know. But it's free for what you're doing here. So that would be the other way. John,
how about Skype?
Skype will let you see the other person's screen. It won't let you control it, but it'll let you see it.
Sure. I thought I've done control because I'm looking here. Where is it? Let me see. Contacts, conversations. No, not in this version.
Now,
I've done remote control with Skype.
Now, you can't. Skype has, to my knowledge, never done remote control. So. Yeah, but TeamViewer does and AIM does. So there you go.
Yeah, you probably saw I invited you. I'm running messages actually on this machine here and I invited you to.
Yeah, but I'm not logged into AIM on this machine. I'm logged into AIM downstairs. So that's why I didn't get the invite.
Yeah.
It's okay, crazy.
And I'm with you. TeamViewer, especially in light of a lot of the other services now rolling back like LogMeIn and some others are saying, nah, we're not offering the free thing anymore. I think TeamViewer is the best, and you know, it's not just Mac, it's Windows, I think it's Linux, portable devices, and as long as you're doing it for non-commercial, I think it's really the best thing out there for now.
I think I would agree with that. Yeah. So, crazy stuff. I don't know why Apple buries that, or, you know, it seems like a perfect opportunity for Apple to offer like a little walkthrough, like, you know, highlight, why is this grayed out? Because it's not obvious, but maybe they don't care.
Some of the people in the peanut gallery here, otherwise known as the chat room.
Yep.
I say that in an honored,
I know you
honorable
do.
Way.
Yeah.
But other people were suggesting, and this certainly is an option, so you can certainly do screen sharing. you know, was suggested Back to My Mac is a way to do that. But with Back to My Mac, to do the screen sharing, you have to be under one account.
Right.
Now, you could, if you have an airport, Airport Extreme, you can, and maybe manage it with OS X server, but you can set up and manage this sort of access between Macs. Every Mac has the ability.
Uh-oh. John? How did I lose John? Seriously. I'm not even spiking my CPU or anything. I wonder if John's actually there. Well, I'm going to pause the recording here while we get John back. How's that sound? All right, so we're going to try something here. This might be a little crazy. So John is relaunching Skype. Say hi, John.
Hi, John.
Yeah, right. So John is on FaceTime audio via my iPhone at the moment because, and I'm not wired in or anything. I could wire him in and make it sound way better, but hopefully that doesn't have to happen. His Skype, for whatever reason, just went offline. And then you tried to quit it and it wouldn't quit. Have you been able to quit, John?
I relaunched it. I see the window.
Okay.
It still shows me offline, though.
That's not so good.
Skype menu. Yeah, there's a check mark next to offline.
Yeah.
Next to online.
So this is interesting. I thought this would be interesting because we would get you back online quickly. But I'm guessing you're going to need to
Skype from Piezo. That's the problem. All right, Skype. No way.
Did Skype quit okay this time?
No, I had to force it.
Dude, if you have to keep force quitting it, I don't think it's going to work. I think you may have a reboot in your future. But let's see. Let's see what happens.
Ah, it made the happy sound.
Hey, that's a good sign.
Make startup sound.
Yeah. This is it. This is
in application not responding force quit mode.
And if I try to call you on Skype, it does not ring, right? No.
Reboot.
All right. I'm gonna repause the recording because you folks certainly don't need to wait through a reboot, but we will be right back. Sooner for you than for us. So John's computer is still rebooting and he's getting Skype set up, but we did something cool. Say hi, John.
Hi, John.
Yeah. So you're on speakerphone on your iPhone with FaceTime audio, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got John wired into the board. I don't have you running through any compression or special preamps or anything at the moment. So it's not, we could actually make it sound even better than we have it. If we needed to, hopefully we don't need to, because hopefully your Skype connection is about to come back up and you'll actually be talking into a microphone with a much larger diaphragm. But I am curious, John, if you would, to switch from speakerphone to your regular thing and see if you sound any different to those of us listening to you on this end. What?
Do you see me?
Are you on? Did you try our experiment here, John?
Well, I'm trying to get Skype working here. And it's,
yeah, I see you, but I always see you on Skype. For some reason, you're always showing as online.
Okay. Yeah, try to call me.
All right, we'll try that. Is Skype ringing on your end? No, I didn't think it would be. So you have some issue. I think we're gonna need to do the rest of the show this way.
No.
Yeah. I mean, if we can't get Skype to work, then yeah. We could do FaceTime audio with your Mac. There's no reason we couldn't do that. Shall we try that?
I don't get it. One more. Hold on.
All right, we're going to let you try this one more time, and then we're just going to have your Mac use FaceTime audio. We'll pause again for the recording, but I figured you folks would be curious to hear some of this, because this is actually kind of cool. I've got John wired in that way. I mean, I could FaceTime audio from my Mac too, which is what I'll do if we need to do it that way. But it requires quite a bit of changing around. So what do you got there, John? Anything?
You kidding me?
I guess not. I'm going to pause this while John disengages. But we'll be back again. All right, we are back. And John, I think you're back on Skype on your good microphone.
It would seem that way.
Hey, there you are. That's awesome.
Yeah, for whatever reason, it could have been a spontaneous Ethernet port failure.
Yeah, so no one in the show knows what you're talking about yet. All right, because so I stopped recording. What I'm talking
about is I all of a sudden lost connection, and then we're trying to figure out, well, why can't I see?
Yeah, they heard. They, you know what? Let me catch them up because
catch them up, please.
Yeah, because I know when I paused and when I didn't. So obviously, John's back. He's no longer on FaceTime audio via the iPhone. Although that was cool, and I took a picture of the jury rig setup that we did plugging my iPhone into the board. But it a couple of reboots didn't solve it. The final solution was that we found out your computer was offline. And switching to Wi-Fi from Ethernet gets you online, and now you're good to go.
Yeah, and part of it is, for whatever reason, when I was connected to Ethernet, even though the light on my switch was green, which indicates, yes, everything should be okay, I was getting a 169 IP address, which means DHCP failed. So rebooting a couple times
and it wasn't just
to a different port on the switch, it was like, well, that's to me, that was the clue that something is quite wrong,
right?
In that, on my local network, I never get a 169 because it's my local network. So I'll figure it out later.
Yeah, no. Well, my guess is that you either have a bad switch, or a bad port on your whatever your switch is using, right? Because you've got an Ethernet cable from your computer to the switch, and then a cable from the switch to the to your base station, right?
Right. The thing is, everything else on the switch. So all my other my AirPort Extreme is plugged into the switch, or the switch is plugged into it, but all my other network devices, which are working fine, are all on that switch as well. So I don't think the switch is bad. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to get to any of my other devices on the network.
And you can see like your disk station and all the other stuff, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So yeah. So switch is working fine in theory. So it could be the Ethernet port on your Mac. Or
on the mini, correct.
On the mini,
or the cable,
or hopefully the cable. Right. Yeah. No. Huh. That's interesting. Right. So, this reminds me, we're going to jump. I don't know where we were. We're going to jump around a little bit here.
We were talking about remote access and how I was waxing poetic. And then I think I got cut off. So I'm not sure where I got cut off, but I was saying that another solution could be enabling screen sharing on your local network.
And then you'd have to VPN in though.
The AirPort. Right. But if you're doing it remotely, then it's not impossible. And the AirPort does offer you a way to make this a little easier, and that you tell it, okay, I want to do screen sharing and please map from this IP address to that IP address. It gets kind of geeky though.
TeamViewer is way easier.
I totally agree, but and it's free, so yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's no reason unless TeamViewer doesn't work.
Right, right. So John,
you want to note that Apple has it built in.
Your network problems reminded me of something, and it was I don't know if we're going to get to the question or not, but I ran into a weird thing on my local network here. I have all kinds of switches because I've got, you know, the network between the house and the office. And so there's things everywhere. And when I have a problem, it sort of sucks because I have to, like, you know, step by step trace through, as we all do. But I have too many steps. But the iMac in the house was working fine. Right. You get on the Internet. It could do everything. No problem. I had something else going on with a different machine. Oh, I wanted to test the speed of the USB 3 port with the Bear Extender Turbo plugged into it in my 802.11 AC. So I set up iPerf and I figured I'll use the iMac in the house as the iPerf server because it's Ethernet in and so it's always reliable and all that stuff. And I could send data to it at whatever the maximum speed was. And I think I was getting somewhere in the, I don't even want to say what it was, but it was, I forget. I've got it written down somewhere, but you know, whatever it was a hundred, you know, many, many hundreds of megabytes. And it was doing well. And it was like, okay, cool. You know, it was like 300-400 megabytes, I think, a second. So it was great. I could send data to it at that speed, getting data from it. I was getting literally 1 to 2 megabytes a second. Like, what is going on? So I tested it with the iMac in the studio, and then in both directions, I was getting hundreds of megabytes. This is weird. I did all kinds of testing backwards and forwards. The switch that I had in my house by the iMac had, you'd plug it in, it would show gigabit lights or 100 megabit lights, depending on what device was plugged in and what it should show. Sending data out from any of those devices was fine. Receiving data into any of those devices was fine. Sending data out from any of those devices that were plugged into the switch was limited to 2 megabytes a second. Plug them, any of them, into a different switch, no problem. So ordered a new switch, threw away the old switch, plugged in the new switch. All is better. Bizarre way for a switch to fail. So, you know, green lights and even passing data. Fine. No problem. DHCP, no problem. And I could back up. It just took, you know, forever because... And I didn't realize it. It was like, it was fine. So it's one of these weird things.
I think there was something else going on, because the thing is, so I just looked at my
for
other
me?
Devices, Dave.
Oh, you're talking about for you.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm going to talk about it. No, I'm talking about, it's about me, Dave.
Right. There you go. Okay.
Well, I was trying to figure this out and scratching my head, because the only device that was failing was the Mac Mini. I just looked over briefly, because I usually have it next to me when I'm doing the show as kind of a backup. But I have my trusty MacBook Pro, and I just got some emails from Synology notification system saying, you know what? The connection to your device there, has been lost.
Okay.
So I suspect what I was seeing was
I know what it
after
is.
After effects of a general, Opton line failure.
No, because your other computer was on the whole time. We were testing it in the chat room. We knew your IP address. It was not an Opton line failure. My guess is your Mac Mini is plugged into the same switch as your Synology, right? So your Mac Mini and your Synology can currently see each other, but neither one of them can see your router and nor can see the internet via Ethernet. And so my guess is that the connection between your switch and your router is the point of failure.
I'll disagree with that.
Okay.
Well, the Synology detected a problem communicating with the internet.
No.
Reported that in an email.
Synology detected a problem. Those emails come from Synology's servers, not from your disk station.
So they had a problem communicating.
They had not heard from your disk station, and so they send you an email saying your disk station is offline.
All right. So why wouldn't you conclude that that's a general network problem?
Because you're still having that problem with your Ethernet connection, despite the fact that via Wi-Fi, which comes from your router directly, we're talking just fine.
Okay.
Right. Here's a good test.
I totally understand your logic. I'm saying it could have been remnants of a general failure that is causing the Mini to still act up.
No, because even if your Internet connection goes down, dude, you're going to get a DHCP address.
All right. I'm absolutely wrong to assume that it was a Optima failure. Well, are you okay with that?
Well, yeah, because
it's not at all possible that there could have been a temporary disruption in my optimum connection.
That's true. If there was, it's irrelevant, because an Opton line failure would not cause DHCP failure internal to your network.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, no, I can't wait to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. My guess is that the connection, well, a good way to test it is your MacBook Pro is only connected via Wi-Fi, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So your Mac Mini has, can your MacBook Pro see your Synology disk station?
As far as I can see, it's in the sidebar. Yes.
Can you connect to it? This is the test. This is how I deal with my network at home, because I have too many of these things.
It says connecting.
Yeah.
And it still says connecting.
Aha. still connecting.
Yeah. Let's see if we try to connect to the Mini. Nope. Mini came right up. Okay.
Because it's over Wi-Fi. Right. I mean, that's how we're talking, right? You're connected via Skype over Wi-Fi on the Mini. So yeah, the Mini would, it makes sense that the Mini would be seeable, but, I bet you've got a bad connection somehow between your switch and your router.
Yeah. Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all the lights are green.
I just threw away a switch.
I know.
it sucks, but it's how it works. What kind of switch is that? Is it gigabit or 100 megabit?
It's a monoprice 8-port. Yeah, it was like $25.
Oh, yeah.
It's worked for ages.
Yeah.
Flawlessly.
Listen, my cheap Netgear switch. I mean, they're, you know, these consumer grade gigabit switches are cheap and worth it. They work for a little while. I've been through a lot of them. I throw them out more than any other piece of hardware. I probably throw away one. Well, I replace one every year. And I have three or four of them in my mix here. Oftentimes I'm able to get a replacement from the vendor, you know, cause it's in warranty mode or whatever, but I knew this one in the house was not. So I just threw it away and I bought a new one. I got one from Amazon. I can't remember the brand name. I'll find it while we're talking here, but, they're cheap and they don't always, they fail in weird ways. I've never had one fail the same as another, although I've had bad ports happen on all of them. So I guess that's fair. But I'm sure that's what's going on. I got the,
that makes me sad.
I got a TP-Link. Yes. Good quality, well-known brand. TP-Link gigabit switch for $24, 8 ports.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's fine. You know? So that's that. Somebody in the chat room was asking if this was pre-show. No, this is the middle of a very weird show is what this is, folks. But that's, you know, that's how it works. So I put a link in the show notes, for that switch. If you want to buy it, the reason I bought it was it's like all of them, it's cheap and worth it. And now it works fine. And I assume it will fail. It's got I think that one's got a 3-year warranty So I'm hoping that the first time it fails is within the first 3 years. I think, I don't know. It doesn't matter. Just they're cheap. You just throw them away. Okay. What else do we got to talk about here? Oh, Paul has a great question. And so we will jump to Paul as soon as I can get my bearings here. It's a little, it's been a little weird. Paul says, I have outgrown my 2 terabyte external hard drive and need to get a 3 terabyte or even better, a 4 terabyte drive. I can't seem to find one that doesn't need external power, however, which rather hampers portability. Do you know of a drive, ideally USB 3, that is 3 to 4 terabytes and doesn't need to be connected to an external power source? I've got data in the cloud and on my Synology, but I like to carry an encrypted hard drive with me as well for instant access. So the problem is to get a drive to be bus powered, you typically, the buses are only going to be able to drive drives that spin the 2.5-inch drives, like laptop size drives, right? And typically over the bus, you're not going to find a 3.5 to a full size drive that's going to that's going to be able to be bus powered. And the problem is we don't have any 4 terabyte laptop drives, at least none that I know of. So you can't put one in an enclosure that's going to be bus powerable because they don't exist. But Seagate solved this problem by putting 2 2.5-inch 2 terabyte drives in and striping them together. It's called the Backup Plus Fast External. Seagate Backup Plus Fast External. Obviously, we'll put a link in the show notes because it's how we roll. This drive, they stripe them together. I think you can change it and mirror them. So you've got 2 2-terabyte drives and, you know, 2 terabytes of storage that's mirrored. But out of the box, it comes striped, which means that both drives are just concatenated together into one volume. And it's one little black box. You may not even be able to mirror it. I'm not sure. I seem to remember that you could. There was some way, maybe they Maybe they told me that, like kind of off the record. I don't know. Maybe they didn't. I forget. But it gets gonna out of the box for you, Paul. It's gonna solve this problem. And what's cool is you get 4 terabytes, and it's super fast. I tested it again this morning when I got Paul's email. I was getting 220 megabyte a second reads and writes on USB 3. So that's pretty screaming for, you know, for laptop sized drives that aren't SSDs. Right. And the thing is, like, it's like $260 or something. I mean, it's not, you know, exorbitantly priced. There is one caveat I have, though, with this, and they solve this problem with the cable that they send with it, but a single USB cable is not enough to power this thing because there's two spindles in it. The way they solve it is they ship you a Y cable. And so it's got one port that plugs into the drive, and then it's got two USB cables on the other end of it. One of them is data and power, and the other, it says it on there, is power only. And I actually tried this by powering it separately from the computer, and it works totally fine. But you just plug both USB ports into your Mac, and you can do this on a laptop as long as you've got two USB ports on it, and you'll get enough power to this thing. Everything I tried it on, it worked with. But that's the caveat, is you need to plug it in twice in order to get the power for both drives to spin. But it does make it portable. I mean, it is, you know, it's how it works. So fun, right, John?
Absolutely, Dave.
Yeah.
Now you may be asking yourself,
what do I ask?
This sounds like a common problem, Dave.
It does.
Now, I know that Paul did not ask about Thunderbolt. But if he did, Dave,
yeah,
would I tell him? Well, we saw something similar, if you recall, and I actually penned a little ditty about this. Western Digital, when we were at Macworld, introduced a portable Thunderbolt-powered dual drive solution, which, guess what? You can get up to 4 terabytes with it.
Because you can manage.
Well, they basically did kind of the same thing here. So they managed, I guess, to use drives with low enough power requirements that they could put two of them in this enclosure, and it could be powered by the Thunderbolt port. And as you were talking about, so you can do, you know, and I'll paste the link to the article here. But no, I thought it was kind of a big deal because this is a problem with any technology, is eventually you get to the point where you want, you know, more capacity than the bus can supply. But in this case, their drive does allow you to do this over Thunderbolt. So, and it does RAID 0, RAID 1. The pricing that I had at the point in time, a 2 terabyte drive, $299, 4 terabyte, $429. So you'll pay for it.
You're paying for the Thunderbolt premium as part of that. That's right. Yep.
Right. Yep. And also that, hey, you know, you can have 4 terabytes in a single drive, and it includes the cable in the drive, which is pretty
sticky. Right. That's true. That's a huge thing with Thunderbolt. That's right. Yeah. It's like that LaCie Rugged, right? The new one that has the Thunderbolt cable literally built into it. That thing's awesome. I like that thing, especially 500 gigs on an SSD. It's screaming. Cool.
Terabytes, man. So what is coming next?
I know. We're going to need
petabytes.
Petabytes in your pocket. That's whoever uses that marketing slogan. You know, they're the first ones, right?
Petabytes in your pocket. Petapocket. The Petapocket. Trademark it now.
That's right. Go get the domain quick. Is anybody own that domain?
Pocket.
Oh, it's petapocket.com.
Now, is it going to be for pets or petabyte drives?
It does not exist. Petapocket.com. And I'm not going to register it. So there you go. That's our gift to
you. You want to put a pet in your pocket, like maybe a Hector in your pocket? Come on.
Dude, Hector's having some issues. She's laying eggs.
Now, I saw Lisa said she was snuggling Hector the other day, which I don't usually associate the word snuggle and Hector D. Bird in the same sentence.
No, most birds will snuggle. Hector's not one of them, but Hector has come around. She's gotten a lot too friendly, and I think the issue, that's part of the issue, is she started laying eggs. I think she's in love with somebody in the house.
Could be all of you.
Yeah, no, I think
it'll be Lucas. You told me she has Lucas. The best relationship with Lucas.
Yeah.
She's got a crush on Lucas? Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, you know,
he's too old for her.
Well, she's had he's also the wrong species, but, you know, that's just nitpicking. Yeah.
That's a judgment call.
Yeah. She's 21 years old, and she.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. She was and younger. She had a really kind of rough start. She never really had people that took really, she's a Hector's an African gray parrot. For those of you that don't know, she started life at working, at working. She was, at she Ambrosia, but she, the people there, and I don't fault them entirely. But in the beginning, the people there didn't really understand what it was like to take care of a bird. And then, Magnus took over and brought her home. But Magnus, his whole goal, and he had her at home for a long time, like 5 or 6 years, I think. But his whole goal with her was to prep her and make her a bird that someone else would then want to have. This was really his thing. So when you tweeted a year ago, it was almost exactly a year ago, that, you know, we should adopt Hector. John was like, oh, finally, you know, here, it's perfect match because I've groomed this bird to come home and right. So, she's never really had a family to, and anyone to really dote on her and hasn't really ever been, owned by a bird person. Lisa, you know, Lisa is a bird person. So Hector's gone through a lot of changes in the last year is what I'm trying to say. And a lot of them are things that would make a bird more comfortable. And so now after 21 years, you know, she's really comfortable and, is perhaps a little too comfortable, or maybe changes happen too quickly. And so she's laying more eggs than she should be and roosting on them and all that. But that, this is the Mac Geek Gab, right? So you can follow Hector D Byrd, D B Y R D on Twitter. And she,
I did. Yeah, I put it in the room.
Perfect. Awesome. All right. So, we already talked about how an iMac could slow down the rest of the network, but I have one. I think it's time to talk. You know what it is time to do, John, is talk about our second sponsor, which is Squarespace. Squarespace.com/MGG is where you go to start your wonderful experience that you're going to have. Squarespace is a place where you can build and host a website. They've merged it into one. It's all web-based. You can do it from any computer. You go in and you just pick a template. You can start with one of theirs and you can customize it as much or as little as you want. Every one of their templates is built and tested. They're crazy. They take like 3 months to build each one of these templates. Obviously they have people working on more than one template simultaneously, so they're constantly releasing new ones, but they spend a lot of time. Every template is fully responsive, which what it means is you can load the page on any device and it will be the right size for that device. They don't change your name. You know, sometimes you see sites where it's like, you know, www.site.com. And then when you visit with your iPhone, you get redirected to m.site.com for mobile or whatever. And then it's stupid. You try to share a URL and it doesn't work because, you know, somebody on a desktop is getting, they don't do that. They build responsive sites, which means the same page, the same code, when you shrink it down or when it gets loaded on a device, say the size of your iPhone, it automatically reformats itself so that you get a good experience there. And the same page renders perfectly well on your desktop too. So every template they have is responsive and you just get to use these. It's just how it works as part of your plan with Squarespace. And plans are cheap. They're $8 a month if you sign up for a year. And let's be honest, if you're going to go and sign up for a website, you might as well sign up for a year. You're not going to change web hosts all the time, right? So sign up for a year, you get $8. And then here's where you really begin to save. You use the coupon code MGG and you save 10% on top of that, right? So it's pretty big savings here and it's pretty cheap and you can constantly change your website. You can put a blog up where you publish to the blog. They've got an app for the iPhone where you can publish blog entries. I've done it. My DaveTheNerd.com blog is there. And if your site is there, tell us, because what we're going to do is you tweet to us at MacGeekGab. We're at twitter.com/MacGeekGab. Tweet to us that your site's on Squarespace and please use the hashtag Squarespace shout out. And then what we'll do is we'll take that and share it with everybody we know and maybe get you some more visitors and more exposure for your website. So check it all out. They make it super easy to customize and really build a nice looking site very, very quickly. Squarespace shout out is the hashtag. Squarespace.com/MGG is where you start. And yeah, I know I'm giving you three things. MGG is the most important one because that's the one that saves you 10% on your first order. You'll get a 2-week trial with them. But when it comes time to place that order, make sure you please use that coupon code MGG and then you're good to go. So check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG gets you started. Enjoy. You're going to love it. I do. It's great. All right. With that, I want to go to Helma, John, because
this
couldn't we had a little bit of a SmackDown planned anyway. Not a SmackDown, but we had.
Well, you got SmackDown.
What's that?
Victorious.
I'm not sure.
I was victorious.
I'm not sure that we're going to see how this goes.
We're having a spirited discussion, which
we'll
let bleed out.
Yeah, well, and it's related to what the problem that you had, right? Because your problem.
Are you saying I have a problem?
Well, you do have a problem with the connection between your Switch and your base station.
I don't think
station.
It's my problem. I think it's someone else's problem.
Well, it depends on how you look at that. That's right. Do you have a guy that you pay to manage your network? If so, it's his problem. All right.
Well, then it's my problem.
Okay.
Me.
Yeah. All right.
Don't pay me.
Yeah. Well, you do. You feed yourself.
It comes
don't
out
you?
Of my pocket. Though.
It does. Yeah, I know. It's not good. Okay. Helma writes. I've recently become a listener to your show. I'm having an issue with Safari that's been existing for a long time, and I'm at a loss as to where to start looking for causes. My problem is almost every web page I load in Safari, my main browser, stalls while loading. If you look at the blue bar in the menu bar progressing, it stops somewhere after the first 10 to 20 characters and either stays there forever or for a long time until it finally loads the page. Usually I press Command R several times until it finally progresses past this point and the page loads fine. I'm using a Retina MacBook Pro, 8 gigs of RAM, 2.6 gigahertz i7, so not a lightweight machine. Certainly should be able to keep up with the demand. I have a broadband cable connection, and my laptop is connected to my AirPort Extreme through a gigabit Ethernet switch using Cat 5e cables, so I don't think it's a Wi-Fi issue. To complete the picture, the AirPort Extreme is the only device connected to my cable modem using double NAT because the switch can't because I can't switch the modem to bridge mode. At first, I thought it was the wiring, so I've replaced all wired connections with Cat5 cables, no difference. Using Wi-Fi or wired makes no difference. It doesn't depend on the URL because it happens with too many, and sometimes it's not consistent. I've removed all but the necessary browser plugins extensions, but no difference. I have several VPN configurations, both OS X and Cisco, the setup that I need for work. I'm wondering if these are interfering, but I can't uninstall them. I don't have the VPN connections open all the time. They are usually closed. The problem happens regardless of whether I'm connected through the VPN or not. I can't really tell if it's browser-based because I tend to open Chrome only if necessary. And if it's a cache thing, Chrome will surely load the page quicker because I've already tried it in Safari. It's not all websites. Okay, so this is where it started. And this is, it's a great question. We've seen something similar to this before. And then in a follow-up question, Helma asked, let me get this because I think it gets interesting. It gets more interesting. Where is it? Where is the second email from Helma? What did I do? What is it? Why is the thing? Oh, there, right there. Okay. Helma asks in a second email, while we're on the topic, does it help or hurt performance when both Ethernet and Wi-Fi are active? I sometimes forget to switch off Wi-Fi when I'm working at home. Okay, so my thought about this is that we'll get to the second question later, but it's related to what you're doing here, John. So I wanted to make sure to bring that up in the discussion. I am nearly certain that this is a DNS issue because the first thing Safari does a lookup for the domain that you are connecting to, and it has to wait for the OS to return its answer before it can proceed. And then once it proceeds, it's fine. The OS is smart in that it, if multiple things are looking for the same DNS address, once it gets it back for one of them, it caches it and returns it for all of them, which is why refreshing the page doesn't reset the clock. Right. If the DNS request is going to take 30 seconds and at the 20 second mark, you hit refresh in Safari, then the page loads in 8 seconds as opposed to, 30. But it's because the request was already in. So this totally seems like a DNS thing. And my initial suggestion, like I said, we've been back and forth with Helma. But my initial thought whenever I hear this is change your DNS on your Mac and see what happens. And the one I always use because I can remember it is Google's DNS, which is 8.8.8.8. And sure enough, Helma wrote back and said things got a lot faster with using 8.8.8.8. And then the question is what to do from there. Helma is not in the US. And so the question is Google DNS bad to use? Because it, you know, you're still hopping across the pond and potentially slowing things down. My feeling about that is, well, if it's faster, it's faster. Doesn't matter how close you are to what you think your best DNS is. And John, you might, you seem to know, I always look to you because you know some website or some tool that tells you what your best DNS is to use, right? So that might be a thing. So that's my feeling, is that this is a DNS issue. But John, I think you feel differently, or is it the Ethernet and Wi-Fi simultaneously enabled that you feel that you and I have to fight about?
I'll shake my fist about that later. Mm. But the first thing that I would introduce here. So, all right. So problem was presented. My surfing is slow.
Yes.
Evidence was presented, which number one, maybe a finger wag. I'm not convinced that the data collection here was thorough enough, because what was said was, well, I use Safari most of the time. I tried Chrome a little bit and I tried Firefox a little bit, and there didn't seem to be a big difference. Okay. So number one, I'm not convinced enough data was collected to isolate it to a browser or a higher level mechanism, which is the direction that you take. And I don't blame you, because that's certainly a reasonable assumption to make.
Sure. But it also, I mean, we got an email back and Helma said using,
I understand that based on observations from, that were taken from your suggestion, it appeared that things got better. So, and I can't argue with that. Now,
sure.
Whether what was done solved the root of the problem, that remains to be seen. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Being respectful.
Okay.
You know, a correlation is not causation. All right. You said to do this and things got better. Was that? Yeah. In all likelihood, it certainly contributed. But no, I want to get
To be fair, and I want to get I want you to continue regardless of what I'm about to say here. But just to walk through this, there were three tests done after our advice, after my advice was given. Number one was Wi-Fi over using the Airport Extremes, the router's DNS. Everything was very, very slow. Presumably the router is inheriting the provider's DNS, but we don't know what it at this point. You and I certainly don't know what it's inheriting. Helma may or may not. Setting the computer's DNS manually, again, over Wi-Fi to 8.8.8.8, pages load quickly. Mm-hmm. Setting the computer's DNS manually to the provider's address, which presumably is the same as what the Airport Extreme is getting, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. Pages load very, very slowly.
Right.
So that's where I feel like, yeah, you know what? I'd call this a win.
Yeah, ding. Sure.
Right. You know, I don't know.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
It's certainly the first place to look, but you think there might be a bigger fundamental issue.
Well, I just want to mention some other things.
So yeah, no, it's good because this solution isn't going to work for everybody.
Right. So it seems to be a DNS issue.
Yes.
All right. You know what? We talked about it before and I'll mention it now. Flush that DNS cache.
Mm.
Can't hurt.
Yeah, that's good thinking.
We've mentioned it before. So flushing the DNS cache, and we just talked about it. We had a spirited discussion about caches, and caches can go wrong. And as far as I know, they're shared. So
they're system wide. That's right. Yep.
Right. That's one solution. Another would be is that our friend Onyx has a number of options. So if you run Onyx and you go under the cleaning category, under the internet tab, guess what? There's a whole bunch of things there as well. There's DNS cache, browser cache, download cache, browser, and all sorts of other things. Those are system, in some cases, system-wide settings, especially the DNS and browser cache. So why the heck not? Clear out those caches as a lower-level thing. The other thing I would suggest is that if you notice a certain browser, now, at least in the case of Safari, now, it's kind of extreme. I don't think it'll hurt anything. You know, I don't think it will, Dave, but if you're in Safari and it's kind of acting up, all right, it may be a bit inconvenient, but go to the Safari menu and say reset Safari. That clears out all sorts of garbage that may be holding Safari back.
Could be.
Mostly, you know, older caches. So, you know, try that. And various browsers, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm sure Chrome and Firefox have the same thing where you can kind of reset the browser. And that may help you as well. Now, as far as DNS, to speed up your surfing, this is, you know, something rather dated here, but I believe it still works. You may have to tweak some things in the terminal. But at one point, let me click on the link and see if it comes up here. Yes, NameBench.
That's it.
It's a Google open source kind of DNS benchmarking utility. And supposedly, and looking at the screenshot here that I see on their page, they are specific to a locale. So you can say, hey, or I think it'll even tell, you know, based on your IP address, you know, most programs can make a guess as where, you know, unless you try to mask your identity, which, you know, hope you're not doing that or need to do that. But NameBench can say, oh, you know, like I see here the screenshot right now. It says, oh, you're in Belgium. Well, I'll, you know, try these DNS servers. And it does a little benchmark and it tells you which ones are the fastest. A slow DNS improperly cached or just a slow DNS that's overwhelmed can certainly, because the thing is, when you're requesting information from a web page, it may look like one fluid operation. When you think about it, a lot of times it's,
oh, it's not,
not just, it's not just the text and the graphics, but each graphic probably requires a separate network socket or network connection. So you could conceivably, when you're loading a web page, you could conceivably have, I'm going to throw out a bet here, and I don't think it's too far off. You could have anywhere from 50. How about 50? How's 50 sound?
50 sounds low.
I was going to say 50 to 100.
Yeah, I agree with you.
At any point in time, have 50 to 100
yeah.
network connections for open, all sucking down data, whether
for one web
text
page
or style sheets or whatever, right. from a single web server.
That's right.
Now, the other thing is that somebody could be limiting your number of allowed network connections, and that could be your service provider. That's another thing.
Yeah, probably.
Now, it could be on your local machine, but it could be your ISP, or it could be, you know, if you're on a public Wi-Fi, they could be limiting that because they have limited resources.
Sure. Yep. Yep.
There's a lot of things here.
I want to throw one thing in because I mentioned it because Helma mentioned it, and I suspected this to be true, but Alan Schutko in the chat room at macgeekgab.com/stream pointed us to a URL where Google talks about where their DNS servers are actually located, and they are all over the world. So you may very well be local to Google DNS. What I had told Helma to do was from the home location there, go to the terminal and type traceroute, traceroute, all one word, space, then the IP address, 8.8.8.8. That will show you the hops that your computer needs to take to get data to and from that 8.8.8.8. And if you see things like New York and Chicago show up, well, then you know that you're hopping across the ocean if you're not in the U.S. But I don't think Helma's going to see that. So I think 8.8.8.8 might actually be more local than we all, certainly than I thought initially. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes that explains kind of how Google DNS works. Their goal is to make things faster. So, you know, I know they're kind of evil some of the time too, but whatever.
Yeah, but they also got Akamai running on their back. Oh, a lot of people are running Akamai. So, So if you type in an address, in all likelihood, it'll be redirected to something a little bit closer.
Yeah, but NameBench is a good one because that will survey lots and lots of DNS servers and tell you which one to use. And once you figure it out, I know Helma was putting different DNS servers right into the name server, into the DNS section. If you go into System Preferences Network, pick your driver, what do we call it?
Country.
Your network connection, Wi-Fi or Ethernet, right?
Sure.
And click advanced, you can get to DNS and you can put things in there. And that's a good place to put things to test because it's very easy to turn things on and turn things off. Well, once you find out what DNS server you want your whole network to use, the best thing to do is to go into your router and put it in there so that then every device on your network funnels that way. And it just makes it a better experience for everyone. So. And your router will also cache DNS queries. So if I request to go to www.macobserver.com and then John, you're here and you want to go there, the router will return that that IP to you without ever even asking, as long as it's time to live is still within its cache period. So it's all good. It's all good. It gets crazy. Where's this show going? Oh, so Helma asked an important question. Is it okay to have Ethernet and Wi-Fi enabled simultaneously? And my answer to Helma was absolutely. OS X, it's got Unix at its core. It's totally fine with it. And but the one thing you want to do is in System Preferences in Network, at the bottom of the list of all your different connections is a little gear. And you want to use Set Service Order from that gear to tell your computer which connection to prioritize if it sees more than one active. in theory, you would want to prioritize Ethernet over Wi-Fi because, again, in most cases, Ethernet is faster than Wi-Fi. But your computer will route things just fine as long as you set that priority order fine. It works great. At least that's my feeling on it, John. But you took some issue with that, my friend.
No, you're totally right. You're cool. No. One way, I certainly agree, one way to configure your system, and it's critical that you get the order right. And that's the part where I think I'll support you to a certain extent. But for example, the problem I had today, Dave, I would have never known it would have existed if I had multiple interfaces selected on my Mac Mini. Now, you could argue that the problem never would have manifested itself if I had multiple interfaces selected on my Mac Mini. And that's a valid challenge.
Yeah. Well, I think we would have lost our connection, the Skype call. But I could have. But when I called you again, I think it would have just worked, right? Because you're on a different local IP. So, I think that call.
The thing is, to me, I think your argument for enabling multiple interfaces is if one of them goes down, the other one should hopefully be selected at some point to give you as little an interruption in service as possible.
I think it's just convenience. That's right. Yeah.
To me, so I have multiple locations defined in my network preferences, and I have one called, like in this case, Mac Mini Wired and Mac Mini Wireless. And each one only has a single interface enabled. So when, for whatever reason, my local interface totally rolled over and died,
right,
there was no backup. But once I went to my network system preference and said, yeah, hey, enable this profile, everything snapped right back.
Sure. Now, and to be fair on this,
John, why do you put yourself through this pain? And, it's how you roll. It's how I roll.
But, to be fair on this iMac, I mean, the only machines that I will leave Ethernet and AirPort enabled simultaneously on are portables because it's just convenient. Right. But on this iMac here in at my desk, or the one in the office, the one in the studio, the one at the house, all of them have Wi-Fi disabled because they're connected via Ethernet. I don't move them. There's no reason to have an extra radio on because it will, it is going to connect to the Wi-Fi signal. And so there's that little interference, if you want to call it that, going on. So I don't do that there, but on portables, I definitely do. And it's not a problem. Usually what I used to do, John, and this was, I don't know if I did it in OS 9, but I definitely did it in early builds of OS 10. I like my computers, I like my laptop to have a single IP address. And so I would set both of them to the same. I would set Ethernet and it OS 10 totally worked. If I looked in the console log, I would just have streams of IP address conflicts. Right. But it was awesome. And I could start a download happening and unplug my Ethernet cable, and the download would continue because, the router realized, oh, that IP address is over here. And so it just sends the packets a different way. But I don't actually recommend that, despite the fact that it worked flawlessly for me for years. So I don't know. It's crazy. It's crazy, John.
No, I like that. It's pushing the limits.
That's what we...
Because, if I had to do it, I would have two distinct IP addresses.
Right. That's the right way. Yes.
If you don't know this, whether it be on the internet as a whole or on your local network, you cannot have two devices with the same IP address without causing much grief.
Yeah.
And actually, I've seen this happen in the past, especially in the days when I was learning the internets along with everybody else, and we were learning how to assign IP addresses. One is that you'd have some schmuck on the network assign the same IP that someone else had. And then there was shaking of fists. And sometimes you got an alert on one screen or the other saying, this person took your IP address and they had to talk to IT and find out who it was and then, beat the tar out of them or
they deserved it.
DHCP, or actually I still remember the award winning goof someone made one time when we were all doing manual IP address assignment. Never make your the IP address of your computer the same IP address as the router.
Oh, that can be fun, though.
I saw someone do that one time because you had to manually type in the numbers.
Right.
And the problem is they just switch their IP address and the IP address of the router. So all of a sudden, all the internet traffic in the whole building was coming to this one person's computer. Yeah. And it was beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. It's good.
He got it talking to.
This has been a little crazy. I'm glad we did the show today because if we didn't do it today, it would have meant skipping it. But
Network Troubleshooting 101.
Well, yeah. I mean, we got sandwiched.
The title?
We got sandwiched by...
It was forced on us.
Well, we got sandwiched by my issue pre-show, which literally was solved like during the pre-show. And then your issue mid-show. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of troubleshooting going on here. This is good stuff. This is what we do. So next show is going to be Cool Stuff Found because by golly, we deserve it, folks. We love Cool Stuff Found. You do too.
Stack.
Good.
All the shows I've been to, man.
Good. Good. Put them in our list so that I'll build an agenda when I come back. Yeah. I think the next show is on Sunday, the something, whatever that day is, Sunday the 3rd.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll build us a nice little agenda when I come back on Friday.
You know what, Dave?
If
you have Cool Stuff Found.
Yeah.
Or network troubleshooting questions.
Yeah.
Or tips. Or answers. Or cleats. Or air conditioning.
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
Right. You can email them. We didn't mention that. To feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
No, I said feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
Of course you did.
I know. I also said 206-666-GEEK in a previous show, but I'll say it here again now because I just did. What's geek, John?
Geek could also be translated to 4-3-3-5. That's base 10.
So, you know, this was, I've been looking forward to show 512 just because of the numbers. And I there were some things that I wanted to be able to do for this show that timing wise we weren't able to do. And I'm just going to leave it at that. We're not going to speculate as to what those things are because I'm hoping that we can do some of them soon. But I was looking forward to the show nonetheless, even though we don't have a guest or anything special going on. But, it's show 512. It's sort of a big deal. And then we get here, and as soon as I start doing things to prepare for this show, like rebooting this computer, and then we get into the show, it turned out to be kind of a curse, didn't it? Show 512. So
You know what it was, Dave?
We got caught.
No.
What?
Even better. You ready? Oh, I'm so... It was a hex.
Oh! That's so brilliant.
I'm here all week, folks. Tip your waitress.
Try the veal.
That's
right. Oh, man, that's awesome. All right, we will see you on the flip side. I do want to thank that's Michael terrible. Johnston. That was awesome. I can't even do it. Give me a minute here. This is good. This is good. All right. I want to thank Michael Johnston. He's the host of the iOS show podcast as well as the publisher of GetAppler.com. He is the one that usually converts the show to AAC. He moved and he's got some classes and stuff. So, yeah, I know show 511 wasn't there. Hopefully show 512 won't hex him like it did us. But regardless, thank you, Michael, for all the work that you put into making that happen. Also want to thank Matt and his team over at Cachefly, CACHEFLY.com. They provide an awesome CDN service, which means that our files are hosted actually all over the world so that when you go to request Mac Geek Gab, it's coming from a server close to you and it's coming fast. So that's what Cachefly does for us and for you, and they're awesome at it. They really know what they're doing. So check them out, cachefly.com. Podcast Marketplace includes, as I mentioned, Drobo, Drobo.com, of course. Coupon code MGG50, Squarespace. Squarespace shout out is the hashtag, and coupon code is MGG. Smile, of course, Bare Bones, Gazelle, iFixit, Linda, and E3. These are great sponsors, folks. Tell them you love them. Tell them thank you from us. We'll tell them thank you. It's awesome. So normally I'd say don't get hexed, John, but what do you have to say?
I guess the only other thing I can say, Dave, is don't get caught.
Made up.